Back here with Russ Baker, Family of Secrets, the Bush Dynasty, powerful forces that put it in the White House, and what their influence means for America. Russ, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
Good to meet you at last.
Yeah.
After all these years of reading your work. It's almost hard to know where to begin, given how much information is in this book. I think I ran out of Post-its. But I want to talk about first your approach to this book and why you began this and how you began it, because there are people who can look at books like this, even if they read it thoroughly, and go, this just lends itself to conspiracy theories, or this could be kind of a seminal work just about the insidious corruption of power and the power of corporate America in America and our politics. I'm just curious about your kind of motivation for kind of unearthing this after most people have put it to bed.
Right. Two initial thoughts. First of all, when I was pitching this book, when my agent was taking it out to publishers, the common refrain was, "Who cares about Bush anymore? I don't want to hear another word about him." I remember I've got a little thing up on my wall where Salman Rushdie says, "I'd like to hear nothing about him for the next 40 years." But you see, the thing is, I got on this book because I often find that the way we understand something, whatever it is not adequate. And that has sort of been, I guess, kind of the theme of my 20-some years of investigative journalism, that there's always a story behind the story.
Right.
And I started wondering about George W. Bush and whether we really understood what had happened to America back in 2003, at the time of the invasion of Iraq. I was living in the former Yugoslavia, training journalists there how to investigate their governments and how to sort of create a vibrant society out of the ashes of the wars in that part of the world through investigative journalism. And but it became very clear to me that there was work to be done back at home. And as I traveled around Europe, there was such consternation toward what had happened to the United States. And people would say to me, well, what is the story here? And, you know, I didn't hear that question in the United States, but I heard it everywhere else. And when I got back in 2004, I started just looking for any kind of answers I could find. Was there nothing more to this really remarkable phenomenon that a person like George W. Bush could even become the president of the United States? I think if you look at the full sweep of history, he's a standout in almost every category.
Even with the people like Pierce and Fillmore and the rest.
Even with them, you know, they sort of seem distinguished somehow.
Right.
And so I thought, you know, I just wonder, it was so much money behind him in 2000 and again in 2004. Major, very powerful, very smart people were putting a lot of money into this fellow. And I thought, are they just doing that just because he happened to be the most likely to win? And I didn't know the answer. And so I began traveling around America. I went to Washington. I went out to Texas. I went all over the place. And I talked to everybody I could, people who knew the Bushes, people who had covered them, people who served them drinks, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I just said, well, you know, is there anything more to this? And I spent 5 years doing that. And for the first sort of 2 or 3 years reading obscure drilling records in Midland, Texas and what have you, I started getting inklings that there was certainly more to George Bush and to his family and to their businesses than had been previously reported. But I still didn't know if there was really enough there to have a sort of a breakthrough. But about 3 years in, if you sort of walk enough fields, sometimes you fall through into a rabbit's hole. And mm-hmm. that's what I did. And I have to tell you, I mean, there were times where I started wondering, you know, what was reality and what was fantasy, because essentially this is what happened. I began saying, the kind of the key leitmotif, I think, of George W. Bush is this notion of his relationship with his father. And I'm sure
Poppy, as you say all through the book.
Right. Those are the nicknames,
right,
Poppy and W. And so, you know, the Poppy and W and the Oedipal complex and this rivalry, and then the father in retrospect being such a reasonable guy. One of the first things I discovered was that they were actually much closer throughout than has been portrayed. And then I realized that it was deliberate. The the portrayal of the son as a very different person. Certainly he was different than his father, but they had all the same backers. They worked very closely together. The son was always interested in politics and worked for and with the father throughout. So I thought, gee, you know, this is interesting how they're portraying the son as this sort of rebel, kind of a real Texan, a very kind of a grassrootsy guy. And when you put aside some modest differences in style, I mean personal style,
right,
you see that they really shared almost identical interests. And this is really what the book is about, those interests that we don't talk about.
Okay, I'm sorry for
yeah, and so what I did was I realized that the son would never have been president unless his father had been president. And see, this was different. I mean, Millard Fillmore's father wasn't president.
He was not, no.
And so you know, both of these fellows are named George Bush. And I even found that some percentage of voters in 2000 thought that George W. Bush was his father. But certainly he was benefited by the family name and all of those connections. And they were much closer than was known. And so I thought, well, this is interesting. So the first thing I did was I focused on George W. Bush, and I looked at his military record in 2004, and it became very, very clear to me that he had skipped out on 2 years of mandatory military service during the Vietnam War. And I thought, this is amazing. This man is president of the United States. He's opened up a purely elective war, and he's sending thousands of National Guards troops, people who expect maybe at the most to be piling up sandbags by overflowing rivers or keeping right. order in cities or something. They were all being sent over there. We interviewed them. These people were being killed and wounded largely because they were poorly trained. And he himself had gotten out of the Vietnam War, had gone into a safe position in the Air National Guard, and then had skipped out. And I thought, this is amazing that he's getting away with this. He's running against John Kerry, and they're attacking John Kerry, who clearly did serve in a very, very dangerous situation in Vietnam.
Now that was that's almost in the middle of your book when you talk about this. And I didn't want to start in the middle, but since you raised, let me start in the middle of a work outside, either way, all right? I mean, what was interesting to me is how you, this particular story, how you began to peel back the layers. Because the media was viciously attacked when this came up. And talk about peeling back those layers, the reality that, and why that reality was not allowed to come to the fore.
Right. Well, several different things. First of all, those memos that Dan Rather and his unit at CBS News down, I had those same memos at the time they had them. And I was looking at them, and I didn't know quite what to make of them, but they certainly corroborated all the other reporting I'd done. And my initial reaction was, I don't know where these come from, and I don't know if these I don't know if they're real. I don't know what they are, but they are consistent with what we're finding. And so when he went for a fall, I said, well, this is interesting to me. And this is one of the themes of Family of Secrets is covert operations against the public, against the media, against all kinds of institutions. So I was intrigued by that. Intrigued by, as I say, the attacks on John Kerry. What did all of these things mean? As I looked at George W. Bush's military service record, one of the things that I wondered about was, you know, what did his father say? Because this was a guy in his 20s. His father was already prominent in the National Republican Party. In fact, by late 1972, the same time he was skipping out on his service, his right. father was being named by Richard Nixon as the chairman of the Republican Party. And so I thought, well, certainly the father, who was a big advocate of the Vietnam War and very close with his son, would know, I assume, whether his son went AWOL or not. And yet every book I looked at, there was simply no mention of the father. And I, as I describe in Family of Secrets, I actually go through some of the things that the White House started putting out in 2004 to show that W. had indeed served. And very clearly, this was a deception. They claimed he had gone to a dental clinic and there were records of him getting a bite wing, and therefore that meant that he was serving. And basically what I concluded was that they had created this very elaborate cover. They'd spent decades doing this to cover up the fact that he had not served and that his father had been deeply involved in creating these false stories. That, again, made me want to look more at the father. And here we go back to the beginning of Family of Secrets.
Let's go back to the beginning here. Let's start there. We're talking with Rush Baker, and his latest work is Family of Secrets, the Bush Dynasty, the Powerful Forces That Put It in the White House, and What Their Influence Means for America. And the beginning of your book, and you talk about George W. Bush and the assassination of John Kennedy, where he was in...
George H.W.
George
Bush.
George H.W. Bush.
Poppy.
Poppy.
Yeah.
Where he was at that moment. Let's wind our way into that particular passage. But what's interesting is what you're attempting to weave here, what you are weaving here in this book, which is the connections between the Bush family, from Bush's father to Bush and all the people around them, and their connections with the CIA and the intelligence networks of America, that they were part and parcel, that as represented by big business, always had its deep connections with intelligence work as it does today, and that the Bushes were integral to that. Prescott, starting with Prescott Bush, Papa Prescott Bush, down to Poppy, who you allege in this book was really involved on some levels with intelligence work in the CIA as far back as the 40s in the Balkans with Tito. So, I mean, it's a pretty intricate web you weave here.
Again, what I want to stress is I'm not somebody who develops a theory and then tries to back
right.
it up. I really go into almost every story with no theory, but just some curiosity.
Right.
And I think that for a serious journalist has to work that way, that I don't have any agenda. And what happened with this was that I remember hearing that Poppy Bush had publicly stated, some journalist had asked him sort of innocuously, you know, do you remember where you were on November 22, 1963? And he was, gosh, you know, I don't remember. I think maybe somewhere in Texas. I just don't remember.
That was amazing. How could anybody of a certain age not remember where they were at that particular moment?
Right.
It's like not knowing where you were on 2001 when September 11th.
Well, when you contextualize that with the fact that as Vice President of the United States and basically with the portfolio for covert operations, he also didn't remember anything about Iran-Contra, claimed to be quote-unquote out of the loop. And so this was his MO, that he was always unaware. He didn't remember anything and so on. And that was all that he could say. But generally, when he remembered something, it wasn't important. When he didn't remember, it was important. And so I thought, well, that's interesting. And I began looking at who he was and what he was doing back then. And in Family of Secrets, I provide readers with a tremendous amount of factual material. As you have seen, there's 1,000 footnotes.
Right.
I've got a lot of declassified documents, FBI, CIA, what have you. And here are some of the interesting ones. I stop me if we don't have enough time to go into this. But basically on the Kennedy thing, here are a few of the things. And I wrote this. I hope this reads a little bit like a thriller. And I want your listeners to read Family of Secrets. So what I'm giving them here is merely the smallest morsel, shall we say. But here are a few things. November 23, 1963, there was a briefing by the FBI with two intelligence officers, and they were talking about concerns in the government that Cuban exiles, anti-Castro Cuban exiles, might take the Kennedy assassination as an opportunity to take some sort of action against Cuba. And this memo is interesting because there are two named intelligence officers who were involved with this briefing. One of them, it says, is George Bush of the CIA. Now, that made my eyes fly wide open, because what we know about H.W. or Poppy Bush is that in 1976, that's 13 years later, he was named by President Ford as director of the CIA, which shocked everybody because they said this guy is a lightweight. He doesn't have much experience. He has no background at all in intelligence matters. Why would they put him in? And nobody really bothered to sort of try to find the answer. And here we are 13 years earlier at the time of the Kennedy assassination, and he's basically some sort of officer.
Let me ask you a question about that. I've read some critiques of that part of your book, and as I read the book as well. So so there was this memo that existed. I mean, and this phone call existed to this George Bush working for the CIA. And then this other George Bush popped up as having worked for the CIA.
Cover, yes.
But then he even said,
"It's not me.
It's not me. I wasn't there."
He was brought in only for a few months, right at the moment of the Kennedy assassination. Actually recruited. He was like a clerk.
Right.
He was recruited from another agency, and the second the assassination was over,
he's gone.
Yeah.
So talk the bottom line for you and what you've discovered. What makes you think that George Bush, who did that phone call that day, and then was that George Bush?
Okay,
is our former president number one, George Bush.
Well, first of all, there's the backstory to that I provide in the chapter leading up to that is what he was doing before that.
Right.
And now we go back from 1963 to 1953 and another memo, declassified CIA memos, referring to the startup of an oil company called Zapata Offshore, a little tiny nothing oil company with a couple of rigs they would loan out. And here's Poppy, and I've got his records, and he's traveling all over the world. I mean, he's going more places than Hillary Clinton for a company with a couple of rigs. And I say, this is strange. And then he's setting up offices in Medellin, Colombia, which is nowhere near the coast. He's got offices in New Orleans. He's got, at the time of the assassination, of course, Lee Harvey Oswald being in New Orleans, he's got...
We'll get to that in a
minute. He's going all over the place. And this memo says that, you should know, this is when he's becoming director, that his company was started in association or partnership with a fellow named Thomas Devine, who is a CIA, this is 1950-something, CIA officer who, quote-unquote, resigned from the agency to go into the oil business with George Bush. Well, first of all, you would say, how did George Bush know a CIA officer to go into business with him? Do CIA officers, where they've just spent millions of dollars training them, are they allowed to immediately leave the agency? And we know from Howard Hunt and all these others that that's simply
so it's been these covers all the time.
Yeah. Right. So that's what Zapata Offshore was, okay? And that was in 1953. And then we see the company doing all these things, as you referred to, with the Balkans and what have you, all very, very murky stuff. It's pretty clear. Oh, then he sets up rigs on KSAL Bank off of Cuba prior to the Bay of Pigs. And he's got, Cuban emigres working for him. And, then people point out the names of the ships in the invasion, the Barbara and the Zapata, whether those are coincidences or not.
Who knows,
yeah.
But there was also this, I'm going to kind of piece something together here how you conclude this. I mean, there was this phone call that you write about.
Oh, you're talking about the second, there's another memo.
There's another memo.
Right.
Where he said to the FBI.
Yeah, let me preface that, by the way. Mark, well, basically, there's another memo. Now, keep in mind, here's Poppy Bush, doesn't remember where he was in November 22. We just talked about one memo that J. Edgar Hoover's saying he's working for the CIA at that moment. There's a second memo, and this is instead of from FBI headquarters in Washington, this is from the Houston office, and it says, we got a phone call. This is November 22, the day Kennedy was shot, 1:45 p.m., as they're announcing that the president has died. There's a call comes in from George H.W. Bush of Briar Avenue, whatever, Houston, oil man. I mean, he identifies himself. He says, I'd like to remain confidential, but I may have some information on who shot the president. Well, now right away you say this is the same man who says he can't remember where he was. And here in this memo, he's identified by name and address. And he says, I may know who has killed him. And I then devote an entire chapter of Family of Secrets to looking into that call.
James Parrott,
right. And he says, I don't know much about this guy. It's just a rumor I've heard that he was talking about. He was upset with the president and so on. Well, the bottom line, and I defy anybody to read all those details and conclude that this call was anything but a deliberate red herring. He says, what turns out is he does know James Parrott. James Parrott, Poppy is the chairman of the Harris County, Houston Republican Party, and James Parrott works there. And the guy does, he's a volunteer and he also paints signs for them.
It's like an odd job kind
of guy. And at the very moment that Poppy is calling the FBI to be a patriot and help, Poppy's own assistant, who I interview in the book, is going to James Parrott's house to ask him to paint signs and thereby giving him an alibi that he was at home with his mother. And then Poppy's assistant even drives James Parrott to the Secret Service offices to help clear him.
So what does that all mean to him? Because also that day, the day of the assassination, George Herbert Walker Bush, the father, was speaking in Tyler, Texas, as you write.
That's another part. You see, what we're looking at here, I've shown this to so many very, very smart people, people who worked in intelligence and so on. Not a one of them told me that this means nothing. Intelligence work is very, very complicated. It involves legends. It involves cover stories, cutouts, multiple fake outs. And this is what this thing is. This is a very, very elaborate thing, creating alibis, creating confusing things and disinformation. But the reason we know this all means something is a third element. The fact that not very well known. A few people may know this, but that Lee Harvey Oswald had a man in his life who was basically sort of a father figure to him.
George de Morenschlit is how you say it.
George de Morenschlit, yes.
Morenschlit.
That's right.
Morenschlit.
And this was a very fascinating a fellow from sort of a Russian royalty almost who had come to the United States, worked in the oil business, and who clearly had his own intelligence involvement. He himself had admitted this. He was asked by somebody in the CIA office in Dallas, can you keep an eye on a guy named Lee Harvey Oswald who's coming back from the Soviet Union? You know, just keep an eye on him. Well, he ends up not only keeping an eye on him, but driving him to dental appointments. He and his wife help them get apartments, find jobs. He's basically managing this guy's life. Well, what's interesting about George de Morenschlit is he is a long friend at that point of some 30 years standing of Poppy Bush. Now, it's interesting because Poppy later, when he's CIA director and a memo comes in and a note from George de Morenschlit, they say, Mr. Bush, do you even know this guy? Sounds like a nut. He says, well, I know him a bit.
He said he did know. He did know.
He had some connection to Oswald, the Kennedy assassination. I don't recall the details.
Right.
I mean, honestly, you're the head of the intelligence agency whose paramount function, I suppose, among other things, would be to protect the life of the President of the United States. And he's not even curious how his friend exactly figured in that thing.
So what I want to ask you, though, is, and in some ways I know you're a great investigative reporter. You're kind of loath to kind of make accusations. That's not what you do. But what is that? What does it all mean for you? I mean, there are all these connections.
Yeah.
But I mean, when you ever look into the murky world of whether it's local politics and developers and people with money and banks, or whether you look at national, international politics and banks and oil and intelligence, there's all these weird, murky relationships that always exist. The Shell thing going on right now is just full of, formally investigated, I'm sure, full of obscenities between the CIA and Shell Oil and the killing of Nigerians and all that. I'm sure my gut tells me it's probably right. So what is this? What does this say to you, though?
What it says to me, after I go through a few more segments of Family of Secrets, the Nixon Watergate section,
which we'll get to in just a
second.
What happened
to Jimmy Carter? And I then said, "Oh my gosh!"
And the conversion. We have to talk about the conversion,
right? But what happened was it began dawning on me as I kept looking at the Bushes and these peculiar synchronicities with tragic American events that I said, there's something going on here that it was completely unknown to me. I was flabbergasted. I said, I guess on some level we all know these analyses by the Howard Zinns and so on, that the way things work in this country is not quite as rosy as we are told in the public school textbooks.
Right.
But to actually come face to face with these situations where what you're seeing is very, very rich and powerful people shaping our country's history, our destiny, in ways we don't even see, and they're doing these astonishing things. I mean, one of the things I do in Family Secrets is I show that the CIA itself was actually created by Wall Street interests. The prime architect, Robert Lovett, was a business partner of George W. Bush's grandfather, Prescott Bush. All of these guys, they went to school together. They were in secret societies, skull and bones together. They dated and married within very exclusive circles. And this is what they talk about. They talk about whether it's Amnesty International or a veterans group, whatever. They all talk about how can we influence policy. People want to influence policy for whatever it is they want, and that's what these guys do. They're just very, very good about it, and they know not to talk about it. And they created the CIA. They created very secret echelons within the CIA. And I want to say, I mean, there are loads of very good patriotic people working at the CIA, analysts, intelligence officers, what have you, who don't know anything about any of these things because it was all so strictly compartmentalized.
We're talking with Russ Baker. His book is Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, The Powerful Forces That Put It in the White House, and what their influence means for America. He's one of our leading investigative journalists. You can read him in numerous magazines, New Yorker, Vanity Fair, Washington Post, Village Voice, and more. And is a contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review. Joins us here in the studio. We'll be back in a minute to continue talking with Russ Baker. I remind you, though, that the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Maryland State's Mortgage Late, Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We'll be right back. And welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we're talking with Russ Baker. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression, and over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. More information is available at MECU.com. Russ Baker wrote the book Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, The Powerful Forces That Put It in the White House, and What Their Influence Means for America. So, in all this, we talked before we went to break, nowhere were we saying in here that George W. H. Walker Bush, Herbert Walker Bush, or his people had anything to do with Kennedy's assassination. You're just saying that there's some really murky stuff that's almost that has gone on beneath this that has to do with these strange connections of power and intelligence and money.
Yes, and also I will say this. When I began looking at this JFK material, I have to say I had never paid any attention really to the Kennedy assassination. I think most, you know, conventional journalists, and I suppose I'm one of the more maybe alternative of the conventional journalists,
right.
You know, we just don't look at that stuff. You know, there is about 1,000 books out on
already,
it, endless contention,
right.
Quicksand awaiting, you know, and I just hadn't wanted, I mean, it's just something I had not looked at. And I guess I don't know what I thought. Maybe Lee Harvey Oswald did it. I just didn't know. But when I began following this Bush trail deeper and deeper, and then I said, well, you know, now I have to look at this whole thing. And so in Family of Secrets, I think there are 4 chapters just on the Kennedy material. And I do go into explanations of why Kennedy was considered a threat by many powerful interests. I do go into that. I also go into a lot of other fascinating circumstantial things that I could not find in any other books. For example, just what was the Texas School Book Depository building? You know, people just say Lee Harvey Oswald was in there. And I looked at how did he get his job in there? What was the Texas School Book Depository? And all these things turn out to be surprises. And then I find out that the man who owned the building, and it wasn't even called the Texas School Book Depository, it was an empty building. They moved this company called the Texas School Book Depository in about 6 months before into a basically empty building. The School Book Depository Company already had offices. They didn't even need that building. They kept their old offices. They moved them in. They hired Lee Harvey Oswald, and I talk about how he gets hired. You could see this chain of events coming forth. You see all these people involved with military intelligence, including the guy at the Texas School Book Depository Company.
Right.
You see the owner of the building is connected to George de Morenschild. I mean, there are too many coincidences here. I think I would love to have a scientist approach it and explain, based on probability, how all of this could mean absolutely nothing.
Russ Baker's with his Family of Secrets, talking about the legacy and power of the Bush family in America. 600 pages, but actually a pretty easy read for 600 pages, I would add. Moving ahead in history a minute here, to talk about John Dean and Bud Croak Jr. and his getting in the White House and his connection to the Bush family that you uncovered. It's a very different take on Watergate than most people have written about. I mean, you see this as almost more of a way to get rid of Richard Nixon.
Well, again, I didn't see it as anything. I assume
No. I'm just saying when you as a fact,
ultimately,
that's what you come to almost as a conclusion in your unveiling of the facts you found around John Dean and the Bush Bush family and the Nixon administration.
That's right. And again, I came at it the exact same way I come at it, everything. I was just wondering. Here I am writing about the Bush family trajectory to the top, Poppy Bush. We know that that Richard Nixon favored him. He actually the only reason George W. Bush was president of the United States and did all of the things that he did was because his father had been president. The only reason his father was president was because Richard Nixon sponsored him. And so that's how I work. So I wanted to know, why did Richard Nixon sponsor Poppy Bush? And I tried to figure this out because you could see, even as Nixon became increasingly concerned about the people around him, after the 72 election, letting go lots of people, he said, I'll keep Poppy Bush. He's loyal. Well, it wasn't really just that he was loyal. It turns out that Nixon owed the Bush family. And now we go back to Prescott again, and the same group Poppy's of Wall
dad.
Street right. people back to the 1940s. And what I discovered was that when, you know, all of the books say that Richard Nixon was selected by a group of local businessmen to run against this congressman, Jerry Voorhees, who was deemed too liberal. Well, it wasn't that Jerry Voorhees was really too liberal. Jerry Voorhees was sort of a moderately liberal man, but
right.
a very, very thoughtful man, very balanced, not doctrinaire. But what it turned out was Jerry Voorhees was a threat to powerful interests, particularly because he, I think, of all the people in the House of Representatives, was maybe the most outspoken for investigations and regulations of big money. And this, keep in mind, this is maybe a decade after the Great Depression. He's calling for better regulation of financial instruments, of Wall Street, of investment banking. He's also running investigations of the insurance industry. I mean, think now, AIG, Goldman Sachs, all of this stuff. And here's this guy back then saying, I'm worried that we haven't enough measures in place. Well, there comes Prescott Bush out to Whittier, California, where Nixon is from and part of Jerry Voorhees' district. And he's in there right at the time that Nixon is selected, buying up a company. They were buying up defense contractor companies. It's, mm-hmm. again, this is a precursor to their involvement with the Carlyle Group and all of this. I mean, this stuff goes way back. So there they are. And even Jerry Voorhees himself, in his little-known memoirs, he says, I heard that there was an investment banker out from the East Coast, he doesn't say the name, and he was looking for somebody to take me out. And I believe, based on all of the evidence that I have, that that was Prescott Bush. And what we see there is that Richard Nixon is beholden to the Bush family and the people behind him. They not only put him in the House of Representatives, they move him up quickly into the U.S. Senate. They convince Dwight Eisenhower to run for president, and then they convince Eisenhower to take Nixon, who he can't stand. They convince him to put Nixon on the ticket. Nixon becomes vice president. He's supposed to become president in 1960. Who wins instead? John F. Kennedy. Okay. And so when Nixon finally becomes president in 1968, there's a tremendous pressure on him to take Poppy Bush, a freshman congressman, and make him vice president of the United States. And I describe in Family of Secrets this letter writing campaign from all these big corporations. I'm thinking, how do the Bushes even know all these big corporations? This is astonishing, this organized effort. And Nixon doesn't do it. He takes Agnew instead, almost like a poison pill, you might say, because Agnew was so unappealing in every respect. Nobody would want to knock Nixon
right.
off and get Agnew, you know. And so anyway, what we see is then Poppy Bush, he convinces Poppy Bush to run for U.S. Senate. He loses in 1970. Nixon then names him the ambassador to the United Nations. This is a man who had no qualifications for this in any way, shape, or form. And then he names him at the height of Watergate the chairman of the Republican National Committee. It's astonishing. And so I was curious about that. As they say, the back story, we know what it was. And as I look at Watergate, knowing that, based on my research, that Poppy Bush was involved with intelligence and with the CIA all the way through, I thought, you know, I wonder what his involvement was. Was he during the Watergate period? So I again go back to the books and I pull out all those titles that your listeners know because they were bestsellers, and there's no mention of Bush at all. I mean, at all. And I said, well, how's this possible? So then I go to the biographies of the Bushes, and there's still no mention of it. And the book's about Nixon, and there's no mention of it. And I say, he keeps his fingerprints off of everything. He's running the bloody Republican Party, and there's no mention of him. And so I began looking at him, and I discovered phone records where he's calling John Dean. And then I began looking at John Dean, and I started looking at the transcripts and listening to the Nixon tapes. And what really blew me away, Mark, and this was, again, I always thought Nixon was the bad guy in Watergate, that this was an abuse of power and he was out of control. You got to listen to those tapes. This man is not the way he was represented. He was not really proposing much of anything. He basically was being led around by the nose. There were these lower level guys coming into him, telling him, we need to do this. There's this problem. There's that. And more often than not, not telling him anything. He, you know, when this stuff starts breaking, like the burglary, he's completely baffled. He said, who would do that? There's nothing in there to take. You know, why did these guys tape the door with the tape horizontally? That's how the security guard could see the tape. And then he took the tape off the door and they put it back on there again. It was apparent to Nixon, as it became apparent to me, that what Watergate was, it was a deliberately botched operation to harm Richard Nixon. And in family of secrets in several chapters. You've seen very, very intricate material. I go through that there were other things before the Watergate burglary, precursors, other operations in Nixon's name that all look like they were designed to tarnish him.
I read about that chapter very carefully, and those chapters very carefully. When I went back to the history part, and the Prescott-Bush connection to Richard Nixon in California made a huge amount of sense to me, and that kind of all fit into where it goes. I mean, I might, I don't know if we're doing the show or not, but the question whether or not the Bushes really the ones who convinced Eisenhower that he should be president. I mean, a lot of factors.
I'm saying they were in that group that was talking with him.
Right.
Because Eisenhower was also being wooed by the Democrats.
Right. Everybody wanted Eisenhower to be president
right.
of the United States. He was the hero of America. But could you argue that you put too much power at the feet of George Bush and John Dean in this episode? I mean, Nixon was no dummy. He's a pretty bright guy. He did have a White House that did amazing things on some levels, you know, besides Watergate. I'm not a big Nixon fan because of the war in Vietnam and other stuff, and COINTELPRO and all the things that happened under Nixon. But, I mean, opening of China, environmental policy, Kissinger. I mean, there was a lot going on in that administration. And really exploring for just one more minute before we move into something else is the idea that John Dean, as kind of a protege of the Bushes, could have that much power to manipulate this thing.
It's not John Dean. It's not the Bushes. This is a system operating, and there are a lot of pieces in it. In Family of Secrets, I go into a lot of these other characters.
Right.
How did Nixon fall? He fell because of the discovery of the taping system. And the taping system was revealed by Alexander Butterfield, who I point out in Family of Secrets, turns out to have been involved with the Central Intelligence Agency.
Right.
John Dean's brother-in-law had connections to the Central Intelligence Agency. All of these people had very, very interesting backgrounds, none of which Richard Nixon knew when they were hired into the White House. And I quote a former official of the Republican National Committee who said to me, "Why are you surprised by these things? The Central Intelligence Agency puts its people into every White House because presidents are only there temporarily, but they're always around. And they have larger interests to pursue." And that was really a mind bender for me. But what I'm emphasizing here is it's not Dean. It's not even Poppy Bush. These guys at that point, they're not, I don't believe, running any kind of operation, but they are being used somehow. How witting they are, I don't know. How witting Dean was, I don't know. But you see, if you listen to these tapes very carefully, and by the way, we have a small nonprofit for investigative journalism, whowhatwhy.com, whowhatwhy.com. The site doesn't have too much on it yet. We're hoping with public support we can do more stories. We are going to be having a story coming out about Watergate with more material about the tapes. And I have to say, when you really study them, you can see that John Dean knew about all of this stuff. And according to some of the other people, he was directing these folks into the Watergate in the first place. So you have to say, who's John Dean? How did John Dean get in the White House? Richard Nixon didn't know John Dean.
Right.
John Dean, we don't have time to go into all that.
The fact that John Dean got into the White House the way he did was just pretty amazing.
It's fascinating. And
right.
I asked him, I said, I see records showing 6 months before you claim you were first contacted that they're already, Eagle Krogh is trying to get you gate passes, daily gate passes. He says, I have no explanation for that. He says, well, that's ridiculous. You know, and so these people somehow... at a minimum, the legal advice that John Dean was giving Nixon was atrocious because it was getting Nixon in trouble. And when you listen to these tapes, you can see that that he's encouraging Nixon to cover up something that Richard Nixon didn't even know about in the first place. Now, this is a very difficult and precarious position for a president to be in because he's supposed to listen to the legal advice. You see, anyway, we don't have time here, but the thrust of that is that what I learned and what, again, was totally surprising to me, as I'm sure it will be to anyone who reads Family of Secrets, is that the John F. Kennedy assassination was not the way I understood it. Watergate was not the way I understood it. And then, if we have time, Jimmy Carter was not the way I understood him.
Right. Let's talk about that. I mean, I think the intervening years are very interesting. And we're talking with Russ Baker. His book is Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, The Powerful Forces That Put It in the White House, and what their influence means for America. Those intervening years, those years of the 1970s to the 80s that you cover, when the Bushes were not in political power, but were kind of honing other skills and building this kind of network throughout the world. Saudi Arabia, oil, BCCI. Do I have that right? BCCI?
Yeah.
BCCI.
Yeah.
Give us a little history lesson.
Well, sure. Well, actually, they were in power for at least part of that. I mean, by the way, Nixon gets forced out, and Poppy Bush, supposedly the ultimate loyalist, the second Nixon goes down, Poppy says it was, you know, disgraceful what Nixon did. I was shocked to learn this. And he turns right around, and the new president is Gerald Ford, who fascinatingly was involved with, was on the Warren Commission and played a key role in advancing the now discredited, I think, one single bullet theory by, he altered the language of the report. And we don't have time to go into that. But anyway, there's Gerald Ford. They tee him up. He becomes vice president to Nixon. That's for a future book, by the way, how that came to be. Another story, how Agnew was forced out. Again, nothing under this in any books. Ford comes in. He becomes president.
Well, he was our own corrupt governor here in Maryland.
That's right. Yeah, well, they must have known that when they brought him in there. He was expendable. But anyway, Gerald Ford becomes president, and there's this thing called the Halloween Massacre. And Gerald Ford, thought of as a moderate, suddenly swings all the way to the right, and he brings in a couple of fellows your listeners probably have never heard of, a guy by the name of Rumsfeld, a guy by the name of Cheney. And they come in, and they're running the White House, okay? And then those guys bring in, from off in China, where he's now the envoy to Beijing, they bring back Poppy Bush, and they name him the head of the Central Intelligence Agency. This is a rolling coup d'etat is what this is. And so these guys basically take over the government. The Ford administration swings hard to the right on its attitude toward what Kissinger and Nixon were doing on detente and so forth, much to the pleasure of the enormous military-industrial complex and to others who benefited from a never-ending Cold War. There he is. Then because of all these hearings, the Church Committee hearings and so on, into abuses of the CIA, but Watergate and everything, the Republican Party is very weak. Ford loses to Jimmy Carter, and there's Poppy Bush flying out to Plains, Georgia, begging Carter, keep me in as CIA director. I have more things to do. Well, what he was really doing was he was offshoring the whole agency practically. Congress had clamped down on stuff, and they could not keep all these operations going, and so they started setting up vast, you know, money laundering operations, covers, phony companies operating inside other companies. They were already doing that, but they exponentially increased it. Jimmy Carter comes into office. He's basically backed by the Rockefellers. This gets into a whole other factional thing.
The Republican Party, right.
And he's backed by the Rockefellers, and they put in Zbigniew Brzezinski as their guy. He's like the new Kissinger, sort of. But the CIA, this wing, wants to sort of take Carter out. And in Family Secrets, they describe yet another covert operation, which is entangling his best friend, Burt Lance, in what becomes known as BCC. This sprawling, most people today had never even heard of it. It was the world's largest financial scandal, and it involved tentacles everywhere.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
Involving Americans, Saudis. It was all over the
prostitutes,
place.
Prostitutes. Right. Yeah, you know, gun runners. I mean, just amazing stuff. You couldn't make any of this up. I mean, it's just incredible. And so you see this operation being run. Poppy is now, you know, in exile, and he's at a strange bank where he's on the board of their London branch, which apparently may have had ties to moving Saudi money. I then get into an approach that they make to the Saudis after the oil embargo, where the U.S., which was already in bed with the Saudis, basically arrange a full-blown shotgun marriage. And we see that they basically strike a deal with them, and the Saudis agree to funnel the petrodollars into Houston. And it starts going into Houston through other associates of the Bushes, again, detailed. And then this weaves back to the National Guard story again.
Which I want to come to here. But one of the things is a little digression, because I've been thinking about this last night and how this kind of all comes together around the issue of power and secrecy. And that the whole, both Bush administrations, the people wrapped around them, Rumsfeld and Cheney, all the other figures that you bring into this conversation, into your research. I mean, in the intelligence world, and the secrecy becomes kind of almost paramount to the operation. That what you're looking at here in some ways is more than just about George Bush and Bush's family, but has to do with a segment of this country that is very powerful, very wealthy, very involved in oil and international banking and other places, very involved with intelligence agencies, and has a lot of political power in our world.
It does. And, you know, you've touched, Mark, on the larger story there that I try to explain. This book is really not about the Bushes. This is about Right. our country. And it's about our country on an ongoing basis. And, you know, even as we conclude the show, we can talk a little bit maybe about Obama and the challenges Yeah. he faces, because this is a permanent state of affairs. These people are right in there now. They own media outlets. They have friends in the White House. They have a battery of very high-powered lobbyists. I suspect they've got their own operatives, unknown, in sensitive positions. The stakes are extremely high. You know, if you just think about friends that we might have, you know, who will do almost anything to acquire that rare baseball card that's missing from their Right. collections, people will go to great lengths when the stakes are really, really low. Right. Imagine what powerful people are willing to do when the stakes are really, really high and you've about got it.
And that to me is what I conclude is kind of the most frightening part of your book. I mean, whether, you know, you can sit and have me or anybody else argue about details in the book and whether what this really means is what you think it means, blah, 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 blah. It's the larger question of power and what this power means in America and who these people are. That's the most frightening part to me of all of it and where this may, really, what it really mean. I think when you wrote about, in the last kind of minutes we have, I mean, you when you write about George W. Bush, the last Bush president, and the cover-up around the National Guard. And I thought about that in terms of your chapter called Conversion and how they reinvented George W. Bush. Now, I remember it was 8 years ago when he ran for president the first time. I played some tapes on the air of his debate with Ann Richards, his first debate with Ann Richards. He didn't sound like a Texan at all. He sounded like George Preppy Bush. Then all of a sudden, he became this Texas boy, which just blew my mind. But then I thought about let's tie these two chapters together, the chapter on conversion and this piece.
Sure.
Because they really reinvented, he really was an invention.
That's right. And you have to understand that many of the operatives in his camp were out of his father's camp. Karl Rove had been hired by the father in 1973.
Karl Rove just fell in love with George Bush as soon as
he
saw him.
Yeah,
look what I have here.
He was a low-level, you know, kind right. of a would-be right. spook type back in 1973.
Wannabe.
All of these guys were, and the father was very much helping the son. What George W. Bush was, he was a creation. He was a creation of the finest minds, expert in propaganda operations, who have been spending decades doing this with candidates in other countries throughout the world. And they wanted him at the top. They strategized all this. The son has to seem different than the father. I have a whole chapter, as you point out, in Family Secrets about how his religious conversion, his born-again status, was deliberately calibrated to what they needed, the evangelical vote, and what they were willing to do to get there.
Right, because it was from, I forget who it was in the book.
There was a memo.
When somebody during George Bush Sr.'s campaign said, "Get Georgie out of here, he's screwing up, take him back to Texas, put him somewhere else." I mean, from that Georgie to President George W. Bush, that kind of transformation of this person was amazing.
Well, the born again thing did it because he had never accomplished anything. I quote a man, his ghostwriter. They were writing a book together, and this is in 1999 when he's running for president. And he says, what are we going to put in the book? You know, let's talk about what you've done. And George W. says, well, gee, forget that. You know, I haven't really done anything. He says, well, okay, then let's talk about what you're going to do. And he says, well, talk to Karl Rove about that. He didn't know what he'd done. He didn't know what he was going to do. In fact, one of the revelations in Family of Secrets is in 1999, he told his ghostwriter the only thing he could think of, only the single thing on his mind was he wanted, if he became elected president, to invade Iraq.
He wanted to take up where his father left off.
And he thought that he had been told that you needed a little successful war under your belt.
Was that when you wrote that quote, was that a quote directly attributed to Cheney? The quote in the book about you need a war that you...
I'm not sure that was Cheney. I mean, I think we concluded that was Michael Deaver or one of the other advisors to Ronald Reagan who had told them that you had to do it. And, you know, Reagan and Poppy Bush both had their little successful wars. Maggie Thatcher had hers. The public loves a nice, neat little war with the cool graphics on TV
and so
on.
But this turned out to be not so nice and neat.
Yeah, he miscalculated, didn't he?
Yeah. Very much so.
Yeah.
So... Again, I want to come back to where we are in America now. Barack Obama's president of the United States. The Republicans are seemingly in disarray at the moment, but there's a lot churning under the surface. So tell me what conclusions you come to, given the research, this incredible amount of research you've done, for where we are right now with President Barack Obama. This maybe not in the book, but I just curious your thoughts.
Well, of course, I'm just at the beginning of my thinking about this. I'm not sure what to make of things. I would like to do the same thing with Barack Obama that I did with these others, is I would like to go back and research him more thoroughly.
His ascendancy.
How did somebody rise so quickly to power? Obviously, he's supremely talented. Obviously, he has a lot of great leadership qualities. He's very bright. He's very accomplished. But still, half of his money, while it came from the internet, the other half came from Goldman Sachs and hedge fund traders and so forth. He has brought in people like Larry Summers and Geithner, who are very much from that same small sliver of the establishment, really.
But interesting to me, I hope you do that book, because what's interesting to me here, it's a little bit of a digression from your book before we end, is that a friend of mine, who's been on the show several times, a former CIA agent, said that, and he led the operations in Iraq before the war started for the CIA. And we talk about how in the intelligence world, there is a broad spectrum of political belief. There are right-wing people who want to save capitalism, and there are left-wing people who want to save capitalism inside of the agency, and they see that as their job. And that so this is really a very interesting kind of political question and spectrum, and how that ties into Democrats and Republicans and vying for power is, I kept thinking about that as I was reading your book.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that strikes me, and we do see Obama taking quite a few steps that seem reformist of some kind. It's not clear how much. But a lot of that is on domestic policy. A lot of that is sort of urgent things that need to be done about the economy, and not all of it ending up looking that progressive in any case. But when you look at foreign policy and intelligence, there's no indication at all that he's making any effort to reform the intelligence apparatus, which is almost completely unaccountable, has never been accountable.
How do you make it accountable?
Well, this is Jimmy Carter tried that. I get
that's
into this in the
yeah,
book.
Right.
And they
around page 305 is when you got to
sort of took
that,
him
right?
out. Yeah, yeah.
Right,
he brought in somebody there, and they start. You know, John Kennedy wanted to do it, and Richard Nixon wanted to do it. Those are the people who wanted to take the CIA out, and we see what would happen to them. I think that Clinton and Obama have concluded, don't mess with these guys. And, you know, he went very early on in his administration. He rushed over to say, listen, let me reassure you, everybody at CIA, you have nothing to worry about. You know, on this whole torture thing, nobody's going to be hung out
prosecuted
to dry. You know, yeah. And you know, look at the Pentagon. I mean, Robert Gates, he kept him as the defense secretary. Robert Gates is an apparatchik of the Bush operation. He was George W.'s defense secretary. He was Poppy's CIA director. He's a career CIA officer. And in the interim, he was the head of the George H.W. Bush library, where the records have all been cleaned up. I've been in there. I mean, and so this is very, very interesting. The people, those circles that have retained their power.
There's many places I could go with this, but we don't have time. This has been fascinating to meet you. Thank you for the book.
Likewise. Thank you very much.
Russ Baker has been our guest. His book is Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, The Powerful Forces That Put It in the White House, and What Their Influence Means for America. 600 pages, but well worth a read. It'll make you stop and think and debate with yourself and others about where we're going as a nation. And Russ Baker, great to see you. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Pratap Chatterjee about his work on Halliburton. That's another fascinating interview you don't want to miss, so stay with us for that. Urbanite radio stories, The Mark Steiner Show, made possible by Baltimore Mediation, the first mediation firm in the state of Maryland, specializing in separation and divorce and business and workplace conflicts. It's located here in Baltimore at baltimoremediation.com. And once again, Russ Baker, thanks so much. It's really been a joy to meet you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.